This reading invites all of us to consider a few questions. How can the way we eat better express the good news of Jesus Christ in our lives? How can we make sure that our practices of eating connect us to other people as a sign of our baptism into a new family gathered around Jesus Christ? And does the way I eat express my love for God and my love for others in the community? Those are big questions, and we'll get going trying to see if we can make sense of them today. I had the task yesterday in our confirmation class of sharing a little bit about the history of the Presbyterian tradition and the Reformed faith. And so I mentioned to the group yesterday that when John Calvin wrote the ecclesiastical ordinances in 1541 as a guide governing life in the city of Geneva, one of Calvin's primary concerns was that Christians are to live simply and modestly. And so in Geneva, there were laws against lavish parties. If you wanted to host a dinner party, the guest list could never exceed 20 people. That was the limit. And the number of dishes that you could serve during the meal were to be kept at a reasonable number. Now, we might find Calvin's Geneva a little dour or a little oppressive or stuffy, but I do want you to know that part of our Reformed tradition is to examine our practices of eating to see whether the way we eat is consistent with our baptism into a new way of life in Jesus Christ. Several years ago, I was asked to officiate a funeral for a family who lived out in the country and sort of off the grid. They hunted rabbits and squirrels for food, but more than anything else, they loved hunting and eating raccoons. Going coon hunting was part of the fabric of their lives. It was an important family ritual, and it was just big entertainment. And they told me, as we were planning for the funeral, that after they had laid their loved one to rest, they would gather for a special feast of barbecued coon. I admitted to them that I had never eaten raccoon, and they simply couldn't believe it. As the friends and the extended family gathered for that funeral, it was pretty obvious that the guy officiating the funeral was an outsider with absolutely no credibility in this particular community. And so I tried some self-deprecating humor, making fun of myself for my lack of country ways. And when I admitted to those who'd gathered that I'd never tried barbecued coon, they all just roared with laughter. And they shook their heads at the pastor, dressed unnecessarily that day in a suit, of course. There were two older women in the front row. Both of them were laughing hysterically, and it took several minutes for the crowd to sort of settle back in, and they're laughing. I saw one older woman elbow her friend, and she pointed to me, and I'm going to edit here, all right, for appropriateness, but this older woman pointed at me and said to her friend, "Bleeping city boy, he's never had barbecued coon." And the two of them just laid their heads back and roared hysterically. Now keep in mind, these were good people. They were people who knew how to live frugally, how to get by on very little. And they honestly felt sorry for someone like me who had lost touch with these traditions of frugality and self-sufficiency. To them, I wasn't educated or sophisticated. I was soft and wasteful, someone who didn't know how to skin and butcher a raccoon. I was a city boy. One of Stephanie's students in New York happened to be the daughter of a chef. And the kids in that class got to take a field trip, it's kind of a behind-the-scenes tour of a busy working kitchen in one of his restaurants. Was in the ground floor of Trump Tower near 59th Street in Columbus Circle. And that was a neat experience for the class. For Christmas that year, Stephanie's gift from the family was a card inviting us to dinner at one of the chef's newer restaurants downtown. It wasn't like what we're used to, a gift card with an amount. It was just an invitation to call a number and make a reservation. So we did that, and we arrived for dinner. And everything on the menu looked amazing. We were planning just to get one thing from this section labeled first course. But instead, the waiter just brought us three different things that he'd heard us talking about to try. When he came back later to see if we were ready for our next course, we asked him a few questions and deliberated about what she was going to order and what I was going to order. We always try to make sure we don't order the same thing so we can try what the other person's eating. He had kind of a confused look on his face, and the waiter interrupted us and said, "Oh, no, no, you don't have to choose. Just I'll bring you whatever you want." And so he did. And so he brought us lots of different entrees, and then later after that, he brought us three different desserts. It was, to be quite honest, a little bit embarrassing to have so much food on our table. When the feast was finally over, they brought us a beautifully wrapped tray of cinnamon rolls that we could take home for breakfast the next morning. And I shudder to think about what that experience would have cost were it not a gift. But to everyone else in the restaurant who was eating that night, it was just another Friday night. Just another meal, just another $400 or $500 tab, no big deal. So now the tables have turned. Now the economic gap in the practices of eating was between me, on the one hand, and the wealthy people for whom this was just another night out. So I tell these two different little stories to get us going here, to raise our awareness that how we eat, what we eat, where we eat, and with whom we eat, these practices of eating are always related to issues of money and wealth and class. And this link between your economic status and your eating habits is one important key in hearing the good news in our reading today from 1 Corinthians 8. The problem that Paul addresses is whether these Corinthians, baptized into a new family in Jesus Christ, were able to eat food sacrificed to idols. Paul deals with the problem by addressing two different groups of people in the congregation. The strong group, as Paul calls them, the strong group refers to Christians who were relatively well off financially and well educated. The group that Paul refers to as the weak group refers to Christians who were of the poorer or laboring class, and they tended to be more superstitious. Now, we may argue a bit with whether these are great labels that Paul chose, but that's the language that comes to us in the reading. Now, the wealthier members of the Corinthian congregation were arguing to Paul that eating food sacrificed to the local gods is no big deal. You can see their argument with Paul in verse 4. Quote, "An idol is nothing at all in the world," they say, "and there is no God but one." Their argument is that once they are baptized into a relationship with the one true God, the God of Israel and the God of Jesus Christ, the pantheon of Greek and Roman gods and whatever local deities you might name and whatever shrines happen to be in the area, these things aren't real. So what's the big deal? Paul basically agrees with them, but he presses them to think not just about food, but about how their eating might affect other people in the congregation. That's a shift he wants them to make. The rich and the poor had different perspectives, different experiences, different approaches to food sacrificed to idols. The rich could afford to buy meat during the week at the local marketplace, and all of that meat had been sacrificed to the gods at the local temple. The rich were also accustomed to lavish dinner parties with other friends of similar economic status, parties that would have included, of course, meat purchased from the market, meat that would have been sacrificed to the gods. And sometimes the wealthier members in Corinth would gather for private meals with their friends, and these would be held at the religious shrines themselves, a shrine that was devoted to one of the Roman gods. Thus, eating food sacrificed to idols was something the wealthy did all the time, and they didn't think much about it. They didn't worry about it. It was no big deal. On the other hand, those in the congregation who were part of the laboring class, who were poor, they could not have afforded to buy meat at the marketplace as a matter of course. So the only time the laboring folks were confronted with food sacrificed to idols was when they had the occasional public festivals at the religious shrine held to honor the gods. So for the laboring folks, eating meat always carried with it the strong sense of devotion to a different religion and a different set of gods. See the difference here between being wealthy and poor in the congregation? Now, I'm following a New Testament scholar, Dale Martin, for help interpreting how to make sense of what's going on in 1 Corinthians 8. Most scholars agree that differences in wealth and economic status played an incredibly important role in the divisions and controversies in this congregation at Corinth. I suppose we don't need scholars to tell us this. It shouldn't surprise us. If you get to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, you'll find that Paul has to instruct the wealthy people in the congregation to wait on the poor to arrive at church on Sunday evenings so that they can eat their meals together and share the Lord's Supper together. Paul criticizes the wealthy people because they get there early and gorge themselves and get drunk before the people who are actually employed and have to work all day Sunday can get there. Okay? And so our reading today, it's only partly about food. It's also about the difficult work of living together as rich and poor and everybody in between within the new family of Jesus Christ. These economic differences mean that we have different experiences and different perspectives. We tell different kinds of stories about our families and who we are and how we eat. What's really at stake is how to practice love for other people in the way you eat. Now, our job today, as any Sunday, our job is not primarily to agree with Paul, to go along with him. Our job is to think critically and creatively, along with Paul, about whether our practices of eating faithfully express the good news of Jesus Christ. You might put it like this. Does our eating divide us and isolate us from other people, or does it connect us to others in new and interesting ways? Can our meals, the way we eat, can our meals become like they often were for Jesus? Wonderful little pictures of how God's love connects all kinds of people together, rich and poor, those who are healthy and those who are hurting, those blessed with lots of friends and friendship networks, and those who are lonely, those who have plenty to eat, the cupboards are full, and those who are often hungry. Now, here's what's interesting about the reading today. Paul asks the strong group, the group that knows that idols really aren't anything, Paul asks them to give up their right to attend the private banquets of their friends and the public festivals. And he asked them to do this not because eating the meat sacrificed to idols is wrong, but because doing so might harm others in the congregation. If those Christians who avoid food sacrificed to idols see others eating with no worries, they may join in, says Paul, and defile their weak conscience. It would be for those in the weak group a kind of religious adultery, cheating with other gods while in a relationship to the true God of Jesus Christ. So to the strong, Paul says, of course you have the right to eat meat sacrificed to idols, but I'm asking you to avoid it anyway out of concern for the health of the wider community. Paul turns a question about eating into a question about love and care and affection and fellowship and healthy community life. Some of us want to stick with the question, well, I want to know who was right in this situation. Tell us who's right, Paul. But Paul won't let us get stuck on this question of who's right. Knowing who's right here is, I don't know, maybe of some importance, but it can't be the goal of our community life. The goal of our lives together is to find a way of life that's wide enough to include all of us with our different economic levels, our different experiences. Our goal is to find a way to live together where those who are in positions of strength and wealth can care for and serve those who are more insecure, those who struggle in the community. So then, let's end by asking, how can our own eating become more loving? How can our own practices of eating become more expressive of this good news that very different kinds of people have been gathered here into a new family around Jesus Christ? Well, just a few thoughts as we end here. We may not believe in idols or demons, but we do live in the shadow of a food industry that has more power than any idol ever dreamed of having. So maybe our faith in Christ will lead us to protect ourselves from those who want to sell us processed food at high profit margins. Michael Pollan, in his wonderful book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, gives this pithy little piece of advice. He says, and this is kind of a slogan you can use, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Now, I'm not being doctrinaire about this, but I do think it's interesting advice. Pollan's guidance is that we should eat food, that is real food, not processed food, that we should eat it in moderation, and that we should make sure that plants are the star in the show and not just meat all the time. This approach to eating would make us more healthy, and it would make the food industry less profitable. Many of us are busy, of course, with our work lives and our family lives and our obligations to the community, and that makes eating out, eating in restaurants and ordering food something close to a necessity some of the time. It would be hard for me and my family to avoid it, even if we tried. But even so, we might want to consider how much we spend on eating out when there are so many people here in our community who are hungry. And we might consider devoting some of what we spend on eating out to hosting more meals in our homes if we can, inviting other people to join us for simple meals that foster connections and relationships. Some of you do this amazingly well. It is a gift that you have. We might want to prepare more of our own food, to slow down a little bit, to learn to cook, to form relationships with local farmers, the people who grow our food. In many ways, Paul's encouragement to make sure that our eating is always an expression of love is a decent argument, I think, for church potlucks. These shared meals can be opportunities to deepen connections with other people here in our own congregation. I read this recently. Potlucks are making something of a comeback among millennials. They kind of went out of paper for a while, but now they're kitschy enough. You know, it's like the clothes in the back of your closet. If you hang on to them long enough, they come back in style. Well, potlucks are back among young people. So I'm glad that we've got several scheduled. We might experiment with growing a little bit of our own food, a small garden, a few tomato plants, or even just some herbs in the windowsill. These small efforts allow us to reimagine ourselves as responsible participants in the way we eat, resisting some of the ways industries and corporations want to mold us into becoming nothing but passive consumers who do as we're told. We might want to eat as much as possible from the local farmers market and from friends who have farms. Christian Seals brought us eggs just a few weeks ago, and they were absolutely amazing. The scrambled eggs we made with the Seals eggs were delicious. Our kids could tell a huge difference. So let me end this morning by commending you as a congregation for your deep, ongoing, and committed work with the Beacons Ministry to provide food for those who are hungry. You know how committed and involved we are in this local ministry. We host two month-long food drives each year. We provide several different forms of financial support through our Deacons Fund and through our other mission giving and through other gifts through the year, like the one we'll do next week. So my prayer for us is that this sharing of food with people who are hungry becomes not just something we do once in a while, but the very heartbeat of a new way of life, for people who are learning to follow Jesus Christ together, for people who are learning a new ethic of eating that brings us all together in the good news. Amen.